Welcome to Inclusion Catalyst with your hosts, Mickey Desai and Susan Cooper. We invite diversity leaders to the table to deconstruct complex social justice issues and showcase the best inclusion practices in our workplaces and our communities.
Thank you, as always, for joining us. This is the Inclusion Catalyst. I am Mickey Desai, one of your hosts. My other host is here. Susan, are you with us?
Hey, this is Susan Cooper.
Susan, can you do us the honor of introducing our guest for today?
Absolutely. Our guest today is my friend Fallon McClure, and Fallon is an attorney, a political field director, a diversity and equity consultant, and an expert in criminal justice reform. She wears a lot of hats. She's a very busy woman. Welcome to the podcast, Fallon.
Thank you both for having me. I'm really excited to be with you guys for this, and criminal justice reform is definitely one of my passions, so I'm always happy to talk about it.
So, kicking things off, criminal justice is kind of a huge, overwhelming topic. There are so many issues we could talk about. But do you think the average American who's not really, you know, woke or involved or doesn't have any touch points to the criminal justice system in their personal life, do you think they know much about criminal justice other than what they see on TV?
I don't think the average person knows much about the system at all. I'm in the system and I still get confused on a daily basis. What people don't realize that varies from not only from federal to state and then from state to locality. And then from even in that, like, for instance, in Cobb County, you have several cities and the cities have their own ordinances. I mean, most of the time they're pretty similar, but, you know, something could happen in city of Ackworth that's different than in city of Austell. And so different jurisdictions go across the board. And so it can be a very confusing process.
So what can you tell us about incarceration rates in Georgia?
Georgia is actually the number one state in the United States for people that are under correctional control. And what we mean by correctional control is people that are in jail, prison, on probation, or parole. And in Georgia, what they did is, under the previous governor, Governor Deal, they did start to implement a lot of criminal justice reforms, and there were some really good reforms. And so they reduced the actual prison population, but that didn't reduce necessarily the amount of people under correctional control. And so what they'll do now is, you know, people will be on probation or parole for 10, 15, 20, 25 years. And of course, this entire time while you're on probation or parole, you're not allowed to vote in Georgia. So you're not allowed to vote until you've completed your sentence, which means that you've paid all fines and fees and you're no longer on probation. So yeah, you're not physically in prison, which is definitely a plus, but you still can't fully participate in society. And according to the Prison Policy Initiative, the state of Georgia has like 970 people incarcerated or under correctional control per like 100,000. That's higher than the United States average, which is like 698. That's higher than several countries, including like the United Kingdom, France, Italy, Iceland. I mean, we have more people on correctional control in the state of Georgia than whole countries have. Frightening. Yeah.
Wow. I don't think I realized what you said about people being on probation or parole for 15 years. I don't think I ever really realized that someone could be on parole for that long.
Yeah. And so you have to think that entire time that they're on that, not only, you know, depending on the circumstances, they might be having to pay the probation monitoring fee of like $35 every month. They're still going to be subject to, you know, drug screens. If something happens, like any police contact could violate that probation, and they could, if they wanted to, if the judge thought it was appropriate, could send them or revoke the balance of the time. So for instance, you know, they might have got a sentence of 20 years. They do 5 in prison with 15 on probation. So now they're out, but that entire 15 years, anything could violate them, basically. And so the biggest example of that, I think, is the most recent, like, Meek Mill case in Philadelphia, where they, you know, he's been on probation forever and they violated him for some charges that actually ultimately got dropped. But even if those other charges are dropped, the fact that you still are coming in contact with police can be a technical violation of your probation.
So how do we find ourselves here?
I really think it was kind of how the system was intended to work. You know, I think many of us have seen the movie 13th, and this idea that, you know, after we didn't have slavery anymore, technically, you know, people were needed to do a lot of stuff. You know, bodies were needed, whether that was working on farms or building furniture. I think now there's even some prisons that do like telemarketing things or something. So it's like this need for like cheap labor, et cetera, it still existed. And so I think that's, to me, like a lot of what our system is built off of, because our system, it's not restorative. It's meant to be punitive. And when you do that, you know, people don't come out as better people. And then on top of that, when they complete their sentence, you know, there's still so many barriers to reentry. Now you have things like crime-free housing ordinances that say that you can't live a certain place if you have a certain record. You know, certain people or jobs aren't going to hire you because you have a certain record. So you take away people's ability to shelter themselves. You take away their ability to make a quote-unquote honest living. So then, of course, that's going to perpetuate recidivism. And now it's like, oh, let's do three strikes because these people keep going back to jail. Well, but we're not looking at like where that comes from. So I definitely think it's all connected. It's historical. I mean, we can go back to, you know, slavery itself, but also to stuff during Jim Crow, like the vagrancy laws and stuff, et cetera, that, you know, enabled especially Black folks and people of color just to be rounded up, you know, after a certain time of night if they were on the street. Like, isn't that crazy? Like, grown people minding their own business are subject to vagrancy laws.
Right. So if I'm understanding you correctly, it is sort of related to privatization and you know, the thing I'm still puzzling over is why is Georgia so much worse than the rest of the country?
You know, I think because Georgia, for lack of better words, chose to be worse. Like, the country as a whole is bad. But Georgia has been slow with doing the reforms. Like I said, like, the things Governor Deal was putting forth with his criminal justice reform panel were definitely a great start, but they stopped short. And also, everything is sort of like a profit motive. And when we stopped having maybe private probation companies, so they're not making money that way, okay, well, now we're going to sell police departments automatic license plate readers and storage capacities. Like, these companies just morph and form into other things because that's their whole goal, is to make money. The bail bond lobby is huge. So one of the things, you know, the city of Atlanta was passing cash bail along with, I believe, Athens Clark just passed it. But, you know, the bail bond companies have been lobbying hard against this. Because, you know, they want to make money.
So what positive changes, have there been any positive changes in Georgia regarding cash bail lately? You mentioned Atlanta. What can you explain to the audience, like, what Atlanta, the city of Atlanta, has done?
So the city of Atlanta was trying to implement what's called an OR bond. So that's like own recognizance. So for certain things, certain minor, you know, ordinance violations, misdemeanors, if you get picked up, you can sign, basically you sign saying you're going to come back and, yeah, and then you don't have to, you know, borrow money or whatever to get out. The problem with these things is you still, again, as always, you have people fighting against them. They're not always applied across the board the way they should be, but then you even have people that were saying like, oh, well, the only way to ensure that people that are homeless are going to come back to court is to keep them in jail. It was just the things that we heard about this were just horrible. So it is moving forward. There have been some kinks in the problem, or not the problem, some kinks in the implementation, that, you know, people that are against it are using to try to find a way. Like, so for instance, the city of Atlanta jail, you know, they've closed it, or they're closing it down, and they're trying to repurpose it, but the Fulton County jail is overcrowded. So now they're like, well, look, we have this space over here. Well, no, how about Fulton County, you implement some reforms so that you can lower your population as well. So I guess to me, the overall question about cash bail, and that goes hand in hand to me also with these marijuana harm reduction ordinances. And we call them harm reduction because they're not legalization. And I think that's a big point to make. Like, it doesn't legalize marijuana. It's still a crime per se, but it's just that you get it's an ordinance violation versus a misdemeanor. And so people are able to get tickets for it instead of, you know, getting arrested. So I do think there's good things happening. Several counties and cities, I believe Macon-Bibb, South Fulton, Fairburn, I know Chamblee was looking at it, have done these harm reduction ordinances. And I think that's, like, marijuana is a way that a lot of people get into this system. So I think those harm reduction ordinances, along with the stopping the cash bail, we're moving in the right direction. It's definitely slower than I would like, but we're moving, which is good.
So are there any organizations or fundraisers in place where people can go to donate towards cash bail to help get people out? Even if it's people that they don't know, but just to help get people out of the system.
So SONG, Southerners on New Ground, they always do the Black Mamas bailout every year. And so they bail out women around Mother's Day. I want to say they might do Father's Day, but their focus is normally Mother's Day. And then Ebenezer Baptist Church, the historic Ebenezer of, you know, Martin Luther King, they do a Freedom Day bailout where they bail out people around Juneteenth every year. And Juneteenth is the sort of like the Independence Day for Black folks, for lack of a better word. That's when the last slaves in Texas found out that they were no longer slaves, was in June. And so that's where Juneteenth comes from. So Ebenezer does that specifically for Juneteenth, but their bail fund stays open all year round. So those are the two main ones that I know of. But I definitely think that it's something that if more groups want to do, that it could definitely happen.
So let me take devil's advocacy position here for a quick second. Is why would I want to do that? Why would I want to contribute towards someone's bail?
Because people have they're in a much better position to fight and defend themselves when they're on the outside. A lot of times we see people that take pleas, sometimes the stuff that they didn't even do just to get out of jail, you know, because, you know, you spend a few weeks, a few months, you've lost everything. Ultimately, bail, the actual purpose of bail and bond is to ensure that you come back to court. It's not supposed to be punitive. Like, the actual case law says that. I feel like we've turned it into this punitive thing. Like, how is that really true when we're supposed to be innocent until proven guilty? So it just makes no sense.
You mentioned the documentary 13th, and there's films like When They See Us on Netflix, which are wildly popular. Do you think films like that can truly have an impact on the cultural knowledge of what goes on in the criminal justice system?
I think they can, but they're just a starting point. So I think these documentaries are great, and it's a way to kind of show sometimes what really happens and to, you know, invoke empathy. But that shouldn't just be it. You shouldn't just watch these documentaries and then be like, oh, that was really horrible, and then continue just to go back to regular life, per se. I think they should be a stepping stone, but we have to use them for, like, real conversations to help put forth real change about the system and how it works and why it works this way. And, you know, sometimes that's going to be hard conversations. But I definitely think they're a start, and, you know, I'm grateful for these movies. I know there's another one coming out about Brian Banks, who was the kid that was, you know, going, well, he's not a kid now, he's a grown man, but he was going into the NFL and, you know, got sentenced to 10 years for something he didn't do and, you know, just threw off his entire trajectory. It happens more often than we would like to think. So I just definitely think that they're great, and I'm glad to see them. They're very hard to watch, but we just need to have more conversations around all of it.
Yeah, I feel like in my own experience, and also maybe due to the popularity of true crime podcasts and true crime as a popular genre, some of that has enlightened me, certainly, on the criminal justice system. I do think there's sort of a pop cultural knowledge that is being gained over the last few years on this topic. You know, I'm obviously not an expert like you are.
I still find it funny for people to say that I'm an expert. Like, I just try to do good work. That's all.
So let me How did you get into this? How does the subject matter grab you, and how do you throw yourself into it?
So I definitely come from a family of service, and so I knew that in some way I was going to have service to my community. Like, so my dad is a retired Marine, and growing up, I went along with him for like Meals on Wheels, and he coached Special Olympics, and you know, my grandfather was in the Navy, and my mom, you know, taught Sunday school and stuff. So like, I just always knew that something with service. I thought that was initially going to be a teacher, and then I was like, eh, I don't know about that. And then my original plan after going to law school was to just become a public defender. But I realized like how many cases and things they have, and although they're definitely needed, they definitely help the system. It's just that there's just not enough of them. They don't get paid enough. So that's how I kind of moved into more on like policy level and reform changes. But then I'm still like, you know what? I'm still going to take cases and stuff as well as a criminal defense attorney, because I think it's important to have like a firsthand knowledge of what's going on, especially if I'm going to be out here advocating and trying to reform the system.
What do you think are the two most important issues regarding criminal justice reform?
So that's like really, really hard, because I just feel like everything is so intertwined when it comes to criminal justice reform. You know, it's connected to economics, it's connected to race, it's connected to class. There's just so many, like, but I guess if I had to, I don't know if I can sort of pick two, but if I had to go with like one, I think maybe the school to prison pipeline aspect is the most important, in the sense of that's where a lot of people get their start in the system. And if we can somehow break up that pipeline and stop having kids criminalized at school or criminalized at, you know, 14, 15, 16 for like some things that are just bad behavior. And I get it, right? I'm like not one of those people that's like, oh my God, there's no bad people in the world and it's just the system. Like, there are some people that are bad people and we should treat them as such. However, when we're criminalizing bad behavior at school, or a kid gets in a fight and, you know, now they're getting criminal charges, and I think that's just like a segue into the system as a whole. And so that would sort of, I guess, be the most important to me. But then, of course, that's also tied to test scores and schools, and all that depends sometimes on what side of the county that you live on. So I hope that kind of answers your question, but it's just so interconnected, it's hard to just pull out one piece.
Is there anything that individuals can do, like if they see injustice happening and they see someone going to jail who should not be going to jail, is there anything that the average person can do?
Well, I think, you know, so there are ranges. And sometimes just showing up and being present at a community meeting, or showing up and using your privilege, you know, or just even speaking out or sharing your knowledge. So maybe you know how these community meetings work, and, you know, everyone only gets 10 minutes. So you get there early and, I don't know, 10 of your friends. So you all sign up for 2 minutes so that you can give it to an organization that's going to give a complete report or something, you know. So just like sharing knowledge, and I think there's just so many ways to show up. Also, just learning and knowing how your local system is set up. Like, do you have community oversight boards? Do you have like youth programming? And how does the juvenile justice system work in your area? A big example of like knowing how your local system works is 287G. A lot of times people get really upset about the police departments about 287G, but those are actually contracts that are made with the sheriff's department. But people don't, they intermix the two, but for the most part, in the metro Atlanta, the sheriff's departments just, they run the jail, they run security at the courthouses, they serve evictions, warrants, and civil papers. The police are the ones that do, you know, like your day-to-day calls. But in all counties in Georgia, the sheriff is the highest law enforcement officer of the land. So technically, they have more authority and stuff than the police chief because they're an elected official. But just like knowing all of these nuances so you know where to go for what and how to even like report injustices. Again, just Cobb, because that's where I live, they implemented these, each precinct, there's 5 precincts, and they have like these sort of like community, I don't know if they're really called oversight, but you can go in like once a month to meetings with the precinct, and you can air concerns and stuff with the top leaders of those particular precincts. And they're based off of where you live. So it'll be your neighborhood. So I think all of those things are important to be able to, when people see injustices, but I guess the number one thing is to just arm yourself with knowledge first. I feel like there's a time and place for everything, and sometimes, though, we just tend to want to react, and sometimes we need to, right? Like, sometimes marching in the street is warranted. We also need to be strategic, and you can't be strategic if you don't have the knowledge.
You can't be strategic if you don't have the knowledge. I think that may have to be the quote of the day. How do we continue to steer towards solutions? In addition to getting better knowledge, in addition to showing up and understanding the process, what's something an average person can do to fix the things that are broken?
I think the average person is just, you know, sort of paying attention, but also, like, you know, there's groups like Southern Center for Human Rights that have been working on these things at a policy level at the legislature for many years, and they're doing great work, you know. The ACLU National has the Smart Justice Program, which is to reduce mass incarceration by 50% and reduce racial disparities in incarceration. And they've launched that through several states and have, like, Smart Justice programs as they're trying to, you know, bring change across the country. So just, you know, getting involved in some of these. In Georgia, we also have Reform Georgia. And Reform Georgia is working on, they have a city-by-city playbook to help people get harm reduction ordinances passed where they live. But it also can be applicable to cash bail, you know, on the local level. So I think even just pushing if some of these things, if you think that, you know, you want to see them in your area, you know, going to your city council or your county commission meetings and, you know, seeing where they stand and asking what they can do and what they're willing to do. Sometimes they just don't have the knowledge or know-how. So if you can just give them something that has, like, a pre-written ordinance where they don't have to work too hard, you know, they might be willing to introduce it. Oh, also, I think I want to say Fair Fight is doing some work a little bit around the intersection of voting rights and criminal justice reform about, like, the moral turpitude issue and trying to make at least drug felonies not bar you from voting in Georgia. So there's just a lot of good work going on, and pretty much all the groups I've named are nonprofits. So, you know, just volunteering your time, you know, is something that you can do. I mean, maybe if that's only helping make some phone calls or send some emails, but even down to, like, the smallest level, just sharing posts and stuff of these groups and, like, the work that they're doing, and shedding light. For instance, the Southern Center just recently worked to get they basically, women in the South Fulton Regional Jail with mental abilities were being housed in deplorable conditions, and Southern Center worked to get, you know, an order saying that they have to stop and have to treat these people better. But, you know, so just being willing to volunteer, willing to share these stories, willing to donate, all those type of things, I think are what the average person can do.
Fallon, thanks for taking the time to talk with us today. But if it's appropriate and folks wanted to ask you a question or get in touch with you, how would they do that?
Sure. They can email me at fallon@reformgeorgia.org. Georgia is spelled all the way out.
Got it. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for coming on the show.
No problem. You're welcome. Thank you, guys.
And that's it for this episode of The Inclusion Catalyst. Thank you, as always, for joining us. And we will see you again with another interesting episode in about a week. Have a great day.
And that's it for this episode of Inclusion Catalyst. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe and share with your friends and colleagues.